Welcome to the March podcast for Neurosurgical Focus. I'm Natalie Pinchem. The March issue is on the topic of endovascular approaches to cerebral ischemia. In this podcast, topic editor Dr. Erin Dumont speaks with Dr. Max Cole about Dr. Cole's article, Intracranial Angioplasty and Stent Placement for Direct Cerebral Revascularization of Non-Acute Intracranial Occlusions and Near Occlusions, which appears in this month's issue.
Hi, Dr. Cole. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
Good. Just getting to your paper here, I was wondering if you could just start by summarizing the major findings from your study.
Sure. The article was entitled Intracranial Angioplasty and Stent Placement for the Direct Cerebral Vascularization of Non-Acute Intracranial Occlusions and Near Occlusions. And just to briefly talk about the study, it was a retrospective study. We had seven patients. It's kind of a case series. All patients were symptomatic with TIA or non-disabling stroke. They all had chronic occlusions or near-complete occlusions. And that, you know, we define the non-acute or the complete occlusions as by catheter angiography as an abrupt cutoff. And then the near occlusion is difficult to define. It's greater than 99%, and we used the thrombolysis in cerebral infarction scale, like TC1. So there's some penetration of contrast, but there's no perfusion and basically trickle antegrade flow. And sometimes it's very difficult for us to assess whether that was a complete occlusion or we were just seeing some retrograde peel collateral. But in any case, we called them near occlusions, and there were two patients with near occlusions. Two patients with internal carotid artery stenosis, four middle cerebral artery, and one vertebral artery. And all these patients, we felt, had hemodynamic events. Some of the patients had CT perfusions that demonstrated loss of autoregulatory reserve. And we placed stents or angioplasty. So five patients had angioplasty with the wingspan stent, and two, we couldn't successfully place the wingspan, so we just did it in angioplasty. We had successful revascularization in all the patients. Two patients, though, did have complications, and they were severe complications. The other five patients had no adverse events and in follow-up have done very well. And some of the patients have had remarkable results in terms of their neurocognitive abilities. And sometimes, I don't know if this is a placebo effect, but I think in these patients, they were relatively devastated or incapacitated. And then after the stent, they had, like, remarkable improvement. So far, no patient has experienced a non-periprocedural ipsilateral stroke. And the mean follow-up, at least at the time of the paper, was 399 days, but it's longer now. In terms of, you know, the salient points or the points of discussion, because I think a lot of operators or physicians that deal with cerebral vascular disease see patients like this, these challenging patients, and I think that people have described stenting occluded vessels in the context of an acute stroke, as well as extending the window, you know, with perfusion studies. And I think the Cleveland Clinic group just published a similar paper, but they were maybe talking more about acute intervention, let's say patients within 24 hours of a acute stroke, where all these patients were chronic, basically chronic. You know, the mean time of when we found the occlusion to when they were treated was like 35 days. So these were more chronic. But basically it shows the technical feasibility of directly revascularizing certain select non-acute intracranial occlusions with angioplasty and stenting, you know, well beyond the accepted time limits or the arbitrary time limits. We felt it, you know, it defines a subgroup of patients with these complete occlusions or near occlusions with hemodynamic failure and continued symptoms that we have something to offer. They may be amenable to some type of revascularization treatment. Obviously not all patients are candidates for this treatment. Patients that have good collateral with an occlusion, you're not going to do it. Patients with large strokes or clinically poor clinical condition, you're not going to try and attempt revascularization. Patients with segments that are thrombosed over a large or a longer area, you're not going to be able to do it. So it'd be patients that have the highest risk of future stroke, focal segments of occlusion that we believe were mostly chronic with maybe some superimposed thrombus, but these were not, you know, recanalized, at least as far as we understand, acute occlusions that are recanalized. And I guess this is definitely off-label use of the stent. You know, the stenting is still considered investigational, and we're still awaiting, you know, Sampras, the results of Sampras. It's just starting stenting and aggressive medical management for preventing recurrent stroke and intracranial stenosis for those that don't know what all these letters mean. And we'll just have to see whether this is something that is feasible. Is it something that is going to be better than best medical therapy? And then also with cost, the carotid occlusion surgery study, whether this will be something that, you know, we can treat the middle cerebral artery occlusions, the vertebral, basilar, things that won't really be addressed or answered with the cost trial.
Yeah. No, it's very, I think it's very interesting. I had another question. From your point of view in thinking about these patients, is there any difference in your mind between near occlusions and total occlusions, both from sort of a decision-making process as well as a technical aspects of how you approach this?
It's very interesting. I think in both near occlusions and complete occlusions, they were very similar. And I think angiographically, it was very difficult for us to say it was a near occlusion versus a complete occlusion. It's like you do the injection, and basically you have no antegrade flow. You have no definition of, you know, a focal stenosis. It just sort of, I think, the case example that I think we used, we called a near occlusion, but that is, you know, I think they're very similar. And then technically very similar in the sense that it's hard to know the actual size of the vessel. And so we would go up, and the wire would traverse the occlusion or the near occlusion, usually pretty easily without a lot of manipulation or force. And then we'd pass a microcatheter through it, and usually it would go through the area of occlusion. And then we'd do a distal injection to see where we were, see if, you know, make sure you're not subarachnoid or perforated, see if there's distal flow in, you know, the distal, at least in terms of the middle cerebral artery branches. And then from there, do a undersized balloon inflation, usually the gateway 1.5 millimeter or 2 millimeter balloon, slow inflation, then exchange the balloon for the stent. And the stents, again, we don't know exactly. We didn't know exactly the size of the vessel, but, you know, the stents were 3 by 15 or 4 by 20 wingspan, something in that range, and place the stent. And usually we had remarkable improvement of the flow.
Yeah.
You know, patients that were occluded were now, it was open.
Yeah, some of the images are very impressive. I think you addressed this partially earlier. Was there ever an instance, it's just in terms of whether or not primary angioplasty was adequate or whether angioplasty and stenting was needed? You had mentioned that in the patients who underwent angioplasty alone, it was maybe because the stent could not be navigated and deployed where you wanted it to. Is that right?
Yeah, to be honest with you, these were all intentioned for stent. The two that weren't were because of technical difficulties, and they were very torturous. One of them was from an axial approach to, like, he didn't have femoral access. So it's an interesting question. I don't think we have enough patients in our case series to determine whether angioplasty alone or angioplasty and stenting is better, or which has a greater rate of restenosis. I know in the two angioplasty cases, they both restenosed pretty significantly. One, I think, went on to a retreatment. The other one we haven't treated, but, you know, has very severe stenosis, asymptomatic. Of the wingspan stents, many of those also had in-stent restenosis, but none of them have been symptomatic. And I think, just my feeling, again, this is a small case series, I don't think we can make any accurate statement about the restenosis rate, but I feel it's probably greater than the typical garden variety 50 to 99% stenosis that, you know, the wingspan registry, the multi-center experience, and what they've reported, even though some of those numbers seem to be not so encouraging in terms of the restenosis rate.
Right. I guess those were my, I think, the main things that I wanted to address. I think the very interesting thing is the, you know, the recanalization of these patients can be achieved from a technical perspective, at least in your expert hands, in all the patients, and complications can occur, but I think overall the results are good, and this provides impetus to look at this issue further in future studies.
Correct. I think that it gives some encouraging results in terms of a treatment option for some of these patients where there was nothing really to offer, and we feel they have a very high risk of stroke. And, you know, whether this is going to be a definitive long-term treatment, I don't think it will be, but it might give an option that we'll have to follow very closely.
Okay, good. Okay, thanks very much.
Sure. Yep, bye-bye.
This concludes our podcast for the March issue of Neurosurgical Focus. Thank you for listening. Please join us for the April issue, when the topic will be Moyamoya disease. For more information on how to submit your research to Neurosurgical Focus or to see a list of upcoming topics, please visit thejns.org and click on Neurosurgical Focus. Comments on this podcast can be sent to jnspodcast@thejns.org.